From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments from scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the second segment in a series of discussions about notions of the tragic in Western literature. What are the continuities and divergences in ancient and modern conceptions of tragedy? How do notions of the tragic find expression at personal, social, and transcendent levels? Addressing those questions are Peter Burian, Eugene Falk, and Peter Smith. Eugene Falk is a professor of comparative literature at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Peter Burian teaches classics at Duke University. Peter Smith teaches in the Department of Classics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Let me ask you to consider several terms that you have used: beneficence, malevolence, order, the cosmos, character, identity. What did the Greeks think about the gods, and how did fate enter into all of this? How did the ancients look in their tragedies at everything that's up there in the sky and worry and wonder about it?
May I just take a crack at this? This is the great question in a way, and I certainly don't have a satisfactory answer to offer, but I would like to suggest that the Greeks themselves had a very wide variety of views and a great sort of openness, embracing even something close to an absurdist view of the management of the universe in some plays of Euripides. But let's say we can find the gamut, really, from Aeschylus in his Oresteia in the great trilogy that tells the story of Orestes and his whole family, to a notion of a dispensation called dike, justice in some sense, which can be, through human experience and really through the cooperation of gods and men, and finally also through the working out in specific ways of fate, of destiny, be attuned to human social needs. Finally, in that trilogy, from an order in which justice manifests itself as blood vengeance, like the kind of feud that traditionally is supposed to have taken place up here in the mountains, where simply finally it ends when everyone has been killed off, you get to legal justice, to a court of law, which guarantees a kind of disinterested and final administration of justice, which is commensurate with human life. And over all of this, the gods, all of this transformation, indeed, the gods somehow preside. At the other extreme, we might take the case of Euripides, Heracles, the famous Mad Heracles, it's called, because in the middle of this play, after Heracles has come as the savior, has come after his labors in the underworld, as the savior of his family, has rescued them from a petty and nasty tyrant who's going to do them in simply to take over power in the vacuum that has placed Heracles in his absence. Having triumphed in this way, Iris, the messenger of the gods, and Madness appear on the roof of the stage building and drive him mad. Madness acting even against her own will. She says, "This is a good man. Why should I have to do this?" Drive him mad so that he kills the children he has just saved. He loses his wife, his children. He destroys everything that he has struggled to accomplish. In the end of that play, Theseus, the king of Athens, arrives and offers him his hand, the hand of friendship. And in effect, the end of that play seems to say, the gods, the world out there is utterly ineffable, certainly not beneficent. All we have is each other. Those, I take it, would represent the extremes. And I mention them because I want to insist on the idea that there is no Greek party line. There is no simple solution to the question of destiny of the gods and so on in Greek thought.
It strikes me, listening to what Peter's just been saying, that he's brought out very well the variety of ways in which Greeks found the hidden powers that we sometimes discover to have been in control of events around us, and sometimes in control of our own emotions, for example, the variety of ways in which those powers can be seen. It's certainly true that Greek tragedy, 5th century tragedy, is a very religious form of drama. But that means for Greeks that it concerns and concentrates on superhuman powers, which sometimes evidence themselves through men, sometimes work through men, because we have to remember that from a Greek point of view, the madness which comes suddenly upon Heracles, as it can come suddenly on people, is a divine force. It is superhuman, independent of all of us, and lives longer than any of us, and so it is a divine force. In other plays of Euripides, he explores the divinity Aphrodite, the goddess of desire, physical desire, which manifests itself, that power manifests itself in Phaedra, and brings down, in the end, brings about the death of a man we would think of as morally innocent, Hippolytus. In the back eye of Euripides, the god of tragedy himself appears as virtually a kind of villain. The force of Dionysus overturns the hero from within, driving him mad in a way, and yet it is a divine force.
It all sounds like it's in the human heart, rather than thunder and lightning and that sort of thing.
In Oedipus the King, I think it's hard to see the forces which may invisibly in the background have controlled Oedipus' life. It's hard to see them as internal. In the course of the play, he discovers that he has, in ignorance, killed his own father before the play begins, and he recalls an oracle that had been delivered to him years before that he would do that. He had tried to avoid doing that, but it turned out, of course, that he was not the son of the parents he thought he was the son of, and that oracle had not threatened him with a possibility, but had predicted what would happen, and indeed it did happen. The force or the controlling pattern of his life, which he discovers to his horror in the course of the play, is something that's already happened, and it's hard to see it as the result of any force within Oedipus. As we were speaking earlier of his tragedy, it really is brought on in the play by his best qualities, not by any flaw in him. It's his pride and determination to uncover the truth, which, and his ability to do that, which brings on his tragedy.
It seems to me important to see that things that happen to the characters of tragedy and are predicted by oracles do not happen at random, but are deeply related to the kind of people they are. And I'm not talking here about relative degrees of goodness or badness, but let's take the case of Oedipus. The sorts of things which we admire in him, in a sense, are also, if you look at it from this point of view, the kinds of things that would permit the oracle to know that this man will do what the oracle says he will do. The way in which Sophocles, for example, describes the killing of Laius, and there's this elaborate reconstruction of the crime in the play, is of two violent, strong-willed men who meet literally on the same, in the same point in space. They're on the road, and neither will yield. Neither will get away. If nothing else, this tells us that one is father and one is son. They are the same characters in a certain very important way. Neither is going to yield. That's one level of explanation. Not the only one that the play offers, but one that we can't dismiss. It's not as if somehow by chance poor Oedipus is trapped into doing something that he wouldn't otherwise do, and the consequence is that he kills his father. He, the act, as he sees, was not intentionally the killing of the father, but it was an intentional act. This man was in his way, and he wasn't having it. And I think that that's paradigmatic for what Greek tragedy shows us. It's never, fate is not an autonomous function. It works through individuals and through what they are. To this, one would have to add the question of the curse. That's the sort of the oracle scene from the other end, if you like. In the case of Oedipus, again, it isn't brought out. just how much Sophocles wants us to think about the past history of the House of Laius is, I think, an open question. But in most of the ways of telling the story, Laius has done something. The usual story involves the rape of a boy called Chrysippus, an infraction of the laws of hospitality. He steals him off from his parents' home, which will be punished, and in this case punished by a curse on any male offspring that Laius happens to have. This sets the whole thing in motion, but the child that Laius has is also Laius's child, and he fulfills the curse as Laius's child, both outwardly, that is, both in the fact that he does, when he grows up, kill his father, and inwardly by being, in this other sense, truly Laius's son. So there's a kind of double view that relates character and destiny in, I think, very important ways in Greek tragedy.
Listening to this discussion, I'm reminded of an article by Benedetto Croce. The article is on aesthetics, where Croce considers any attempt to ask or to answer the question, when is a play a tragedy, both irrelevant and impertinent, which leads me to the recognition that perhaps if we do ask that question, we ought to bear in mind that there are different concepts of the tragic that inform a play, and that perhaps we should not aim at determining what a tragedy is on the basis of any one of the very different concepts of the tragic. Not that those concepts were spelled out, but concepts we derive from our readings. That we should not try then to call a tragedy only on the basis of any one of the concepts. And therefore I would suggest that we ask, that we address ourselves to the question of the types of tragedy on the basis of what was implicitly conceived to be the concept of the tragic that informed the different types of plays.
The variety of types of tragedy, even within the category of classical Greek tragedy, is the striking thing about them. And it's always somewhat embarrassing, I think, to the classicist to try to define the tragic, because when he looks around at the group of plays that survive to us from the 5th century, one finds some of them don't have unhappy endings. Sophocles' Philoctetes, for example, has, at least formally speaking, a happy ending. So it's not true that tragedy has to be a destruction or a bringing low of a hero. It's also not true that all of Greek tragedies have single heroes. Many of them share the action between two or even more equally important characters. So it's hard to find a definition of the tragic in Greek terms, Greek tragic, which is centered on a tragic hero. The variety is just too great. I'm worried about what seems to me our tendency to assume that a tragedian who discovers or implies that behind our experience is a transcendent order is more of a tragedian than one who may write plays which illustrate the discovery of a transcendent disorder. I'm not sure that's a fair presupposition. In any case, it is a presupposition, and I'm worried about bringing any a priori notions to defining the tragic. We'd have to argue, I think, about whether it is a better tragedy or more of a tragedy, a play which implies that there is a hidden pattern quality to our experience, as opposed to one which I think, like Euripides' Heracles, illustrates that there may not be that sort of order, at least not an order comprehensible to or amenable to human desires.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the second segment in a series of conversations about notions of the tragic in Western literature. The panelists in the following portion of the discussion are Robert Terhorst, Peter Smith, and Peter Burian. Robert Terhorst is a professor of Spanish at the University of Arizona and a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's writing a book about the novel as a literary form and its connections to money and economic issues. Peter Burian teaches in the Department of Classics at Duke University. Peter Smith is a professor of classics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
How do social notions enter into the minds of the audiences and the playwrights? For instance, there is an unavoidable confrontation with Freud in our time when you look at plays like Oedipus the King.
Well, Freud was a doctor before he made himself into a psychiatrist. And I'm interested in the Oedipus. I'm interested in the medical problem, which we haven't talked about yet. And that is, there's a plague going on in the play. And I assume that what happens to Oedipus helps to get the city rid of the plague. Oedipus's, the events which overtake Oedipus solve the problem of the plague in the city. Then I was also very much interested in what Peter Burian said about the homosexual rape, which is sometimes assumed to be the cause of the curse or of all the problems. It seems to me that that's something that would attract a doctor, and a psychological doctor as well as a medical doctor. So I would be one way of rejoining past and present here that interests me, or a possible way of rejoining past and present, or joining past and present, is to look at, to use a fancy term, the etiology, the source of the problem. The word that comes to my mind with the Oedipus is pollution, which is, I'm not terribly knowledgeable about Greek religion or ancient religion, but I know that one difficulty with which the ancients often hoped to deal was the problem of pollution. And a striking aspect of Oedipus is precisely that at least that problem is solved in the play. In some sense, if you look at the health or the life of the city, you can almost look at, upon the play as a comedy, where at the expense of Oedipus, the city regains health. So I can see a big connection here between Freud as a medical doctor. Then I would like also to suggest, and now I am really ranging widely, I would like to suggest another connection, a problem of, I see a problem of origins in the Oedipus. Oedipus is a foundling. He doesn't know who he is, who his parents really are. And it does seem to me that the Oedipus addresses this problem of origins and how evil creeps in at the origins. It seems to suggest that, and now I already anticipate that Peter Burian is going to say this is not Greek, I see a problem of original pollution, if not sin, in the Oedipus. It seems to me that Freud, in dealing with sexual etiology, also is somewhat dealing with a related problem. How did we come to be the rather awful people that we are? The Oedipus myth, in Freud's handling of it, to some degree, I think, and in partly, attempts to address this problem. In other words, I see in the therapeutic of tragedy a connection between modern modes of mind and ancient ones.
If, in fact, tragedy has this therapeutic effect, let's talk in terms that are a little closer to the present. How did the transformation occur so that ordinary, everyday people began to have a role in tragedy, and what is that role? How did playwrights manage that transformation?
As I recall it, Aristotle does not let ordinary people have a very big role in tragedy. They are a good bit excluded from it, at least as actors or participants.
It's true that the characters of Greek tragedies, like most of those in Shakespeare's case, are kings and queens, nobles. It's also true that they tend to be organized in nuclear families, and the conflicts and tragedies within these plays tend to be centered around family conflict. And one is reminded, I think inevitably, of the way fairy tales told to children are also about nuclear families and also about kings and queens, princes and princesses. Our children, certainly American children, are not used to the social reality of royal families, and yet fairy tales center upon them because in some way, I suppose, the constellation of relationships that many stories, whether tragic or comic or simply adventure stories, center is a constellation of family relations that we're used to, and these are somehow very often represented in a kind of paradigmatic way, a kind of exemplary way, by stories of royal families. But it certainly was not true that the city of Athens in the 5th century was an aristocratically socially organized city. In fact, the personalities, the characters, the stories of their plays are strikingly distant from the social atmosphere and social structure of 5th century Athens, except in this indirect sense that they concern family conflict.
Well, bringing this into our own world to some extent, I mean, I think that one wants to draw the line not as between the Greeks and, say, Shakespeare, but rather to point out that what is sometimes called bourgeois tragedy is really a very new phenomenon. There may be a fairly simple explanation of this. It seemed for a long time that the really lamentable fall would be the fall from a high place, that it was, in fact, of consequence that the figures of tragedy be public figures, people like Oedipus on whom others depended, people known, respected, admired, loved, whose loss would be a loss not just to themselves and their own immediate family, but to the larger social world, the context in which they lived. It's only, I think, fairly recently, perhaps no earlier than the French Revolution, that people started to say, why should not the paradigms of tragedy apply to us all? Why do we have to go to another social level in order to see this process? It can apply as well to the lowest as to the highest. Related to that, then, are all kinds of questions about the presuppositions of language appropriate to the discourse of tragedy, of a certain kind of almost distancing of the world of tragedy from the detritus, if you will, of daily life. Is the experience of tragedy somehow diluted when it takes place in a world so particularly and identifiably our own?
The world of a salesman,
for
instance.
Let's say, to take perhaps the most famous example, Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. Do we not turn tragedy in some way into a case study?
Well, what's the answer to this question? Does it somehow lose its power, its effectiveness, its in connecting with everyday ordinary people and concerns? How, for instance, let's be specific. How, for instance, would Shakespeare's audiences have looked at the pardon the oversimplification, the tragic meaning or lessons or upshots of plays about two teenagers in love? Were they looking merely at two teenagers in love, or were they looking at households and, as Peter Smith has pointed out, familial concerns? Bob?
Well, one way in which these extraordinary people relate to ordinary people is precisely through the family. And I think that what Peter Smith pointed out there is that the familial structure here is very important, both as a distancing device, if it's a royal family, and as an approaching device, in that we all somehow belong to families. So I would see, in fact, all the plays we're sort of considering here today, I would see very much of a family construct here. One very interesting thing that comes out of the family, I think, in many of these plays, is the horror that is the family. I think that's one thing that Freud was trying to show us, that at the root of generation, there is a horror. And I do believe tragedians and others, not exclusively, they can show us this, that a relationship which is supposed to be protective, loving, and nurturing can turn into a destructive one. This, I would point out, is one thing that O'Neill rather brilliantly does in Mourning Becomes Electra, that very relationship for which we rely on for our nurture then can turn into a destructive one. But this is, I think, a tremendously deep realization, because in the child, the death of the parent is implicit. There is, just in the succession of one generation to the next, the fact that in normal expectation the child will witness the death of the parent, will live on. There is a memento mori in the life-giving act of generating offspring. I think tragedy reveals to us, both ancient and modern, a good bit of that dimension in the succession of the generations. One thing that interests me also in this talking about the closeness and distance from society is O'Neill's Mourning Becomes Electra, because O'Neill makes of the family household a sacred place which people come to visit with fear and trepidation. He sets this New England sea captain's house, a very ordinary site in a New England town, apart from the town. The family keep apart from the town. And as the play begins, there are events which tend to exalt the play, the end of the war, the assassination of Lincoln, these things which cast a tragic and lofty shadow on the play. So even in a play like O'Neill's, which would tend to move certainly in the middle class direction, nonetheless, and I think quite consciously, O'Neill uses classicizing devices which tend to exalt and distance his play. And I think these are very effective devices.
You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with the second segment in a series of conversations about notions of the tragic in Western literature. The panelists were Eugene Falk and Peter Smith of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Robert Terhorst of the University of Arizona, and Peter Burian of Duke University. Professors Falk and Terhorst are scholars at the National Humanities Center. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.